The United States, along with the rest of the world, appears to be slowly emerging from the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. Now comes the debate over what lessons we should take away from the experience, and over the next few weeks, we'll consider the future of capitalism itself. We open our series with a look at how the events of the past year could change the way we think about free markets and the role of the government. Here's NPR's Tom Gelton.
The idea of capitalism as an economic system was explained more than 200 years ago by the Scotsman Adam Smith. In his book, The Wealth of Nations, Smith said a free market guides a society to efficiency by bringing buyers and sellers together and stimulating economies to produce more of what's needed and less of what's not. In the United States, the best-known apostle of free market capitalism was the legendary economist Milton Friedman, who died in 2006. Back in 1980, in a 10-part television series called Free to Choose, Friedman made the case for Adam Smith's capitalism model.
His key idea was that self-interest could produce an orderly society benefiting everybody. It was as though there were an invisible hand at work.
The invisible hand of the free market destroys companies that can't compete, but it lifts up companies with good ideas, ones that sell. The Austrian economist Joseph Schumpeter called this creative destruction. Free market true believers say governments generally should stand back and let this process run its course. That pro-market, keep-the-government-out philosophy reached a heyday in the 1980s in Britain under Margaret Thatcher and in the United States under Ronald Reagan.
I've always felt the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help."
But last year, the global economy nearly went into a full meltdown. Here in the U.S., the Bush administration felt it had no choice but to intervene in the marketplace to save companies whose failures would have set off dangerous chain reactions. First, the mortgage giants, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, then the insurance giant, AIG. The market had allowed them to make bad investments that put institutions around the world at great risk. Many economists, including some from Wall Street, like Robert Barbera, said the lesson was that free market ideology had been carried too far.
We sort of morphed from Adam Smith's invisible hand, that markets move things in a very helpful direction, to some notion of free markets have an infallible hand.
The simple capitalism model that Adam Smith described no longer fit the complicated, highly interconnected global economy of today. In his book, The Cost of Capitalism, Robert Barbera says it's time to update our economic thinking. Take Joseph Schumpeter's idea that it's good for companies to fail and others to take their place. Usually it makes sense, Barbera says, but not always.
Walmart appears. It's very innovative. And many, many small retailers over time are put out of business. That's the price of progress. That's Schumpeter's creative destruction. Conversely, when you're in a position when a great many financial institutions have lent the wrong way and there's this chance for a domino-like default, there's nothing creative about that destruction. You've got to prevent it. That's the cost of capitalism. Periodically, you will have to come to the rescue of the financial system.
The Bush administration, generally conservative and pro-market, came to this very conclusion when it rescued the world's biggest insurance company, AIG. Clearly, we had broken new ground in economic thinking. Not surprisingly, free market purists have objected to these moves. They say the government should just let troubled companies go down, no matter how big they are.
How going forward are we going to avoid a situation like this unless we say, in a few cases, look, that's it?
Thomas Woods is a fellow at the libertarian Ludwig von Mises Institute.
I'm telling you, that would have more of a salutary effect than all the regulatory tinkering put together. If these guys saw that, you know what, they're just like everybody else. If they don't produce, then they fail. They're just like the guy who's a mechanic, the guy who's a plumber. They enjoy no special privileges.
Woods' new book is called Meltdown. Actually, there's nothing new about American capitalism changing in response to developments in the economy. When the free market system allowed monopolies to emerge in the 19th century, the Interstate Commerce Commission was created to control them. And the Great Depression 70 years ago brought another layer of government intervention in the U.S. economy. The free market champion, Milton Friedman, in fact said the U.S. government erred during the Depression by not intervening quickly enough. In his Free to Choose TV series, Friedman explained how the failure of one private New York bank in 1931 set in motion a whole series of bank failures around the country. It was, Friedman said, an emergency situation that called out for an intervention by the U.S. Federal Reserve. But it did not come.
The Federal Reserve System stood idly by when it had the power and the duty and the responsibility to provide the cash that would have enabled the banks to meet the insistent demands of their depositors without closing their doors.
It's now widely accepted, even by most pro-market economists, that in a financial crisis, the government needs to intervene, even aggressively. Brad DeLong, an economist at the University of California at Berkeley, says what sets economic thinkers apart from each other these days are their ideas about what governments should do besides rescue troubled banks.
Most economists to the left of Friedman will say, well, yes, this is one example where the government needs to intervene actively, but there are lots of others, too.
And this is where the debate is now. The U.S. government, last fall under President Bush and then under President Obama, has gone well beyond rescuing banks. The practice of American capitalism, DeLong points out, has fundamentally changed.
Remember those days in September when we woke up and found that the U.S. taxpayer now owned two large mortgage companies and an insurance company, AIG? And now we're going for auto companies, and who knows what's going to go next. The U.S. government is taking over an awful lot of things and expanding its role in the economy quite strongly and quite aggressively.
President Obama says he doesn't want the U.S. government's majority ownership of General Motors to mean Washington runs the company, but his administration is demanding more fuel-efficient vehicles. He says he's a strong believer in the power of the free market. But that statement came even as he proposed regulatory reforms that would bring the biggest government intrusion into the private sector in more than 70 years. And then there are the administration's plans for energy and health care reform, both of which feature major new government roles. Our free market capitalist system will survive, but with each new economic crisis, some guiding principles are revised. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
This month, we're reporting on young people trying to start their lives in the worst economy they've ever known. Most of them are happy just to find jobs. A few are trying to create them by starting businesses. Hard to do even in a good economy. Now think of one place in America where it would be really tough to be a budding entrepreneur. This is an easy one, and that's where guest correspondent Judy Woodruff found this story.
A cynic might brand Detroit as a place where big things come to an end. Cars and companies and big ideas all shutting down or drying up. So it's a pleasant surprise to eavesdrop on something beginning.
I like the concept. Just initially what I've read, I like it.
Was there anything that stuck out to you that you didn't understand?
This young entrepreneur and his partner are pitching their idea to a cafe owner. It's a customer loyalty card for local stores and restaurants. Spend $100 at this cafe, that might get you enough points for a free meal or a discount at the bookstore down the street. It's a way to get people to buy locally.
What do you think like a reasonable price for a transaction would be?
That's one of the business partners, John Hughes. He hopes to launch his idea in a few months.
Thanks for sitting down with us. Appreciate it.
I'm happy you guys are doing this. I think it's what we need in the neighborhood, especially in today's economy.
John Hughes' plan is ambitious. He's 25, which is roughly the same number of years that his father worked at GM. From their home in the suburbs, his family watched as Detroit slowly ran out of gas. If he can help residents buy locally, he says, it'll be like giving the city its own stimulus package.
And that's really allows me to get really excited about the idea. Whereas if I was just opening up another real estate company or doing something like that, I don't know if I'd be as excited about it because it's just like, okay, I can make money, but is that all I'm going to do at the end of the day?
Your idea, how much research and testing have you done to see whether it's really viable or not?
We've done lots of research. We work in the office 8 to 12 hours a day. We work weekends. I mean, there's not a time off. I mean, that's one of the most stressful parts is, like, even when you want to go to sleep on a Saturday night, you're still thinking about this business.
He says he'll need up to $200,000 to launch his business, which may sound impossible for a first-time entrepreneur in a bad economy in a battered city. But John and his partner have help.
You pull your financials back up. I mean, there's just a couple of points to...
Help from Bizdom University, a nonprofit that teaches people how to start businesses and gives them money to launch them. Sounds like a pretty good deal, except not all ideas get launched, and those that do get pummeled into shape first.
Israel, there are parts of this that I absolutely love. There are parts of this that I absolutely hate.
Here's a Bizdom student asking his advisor how he can push his product in a crowded market.
How can we get out there as a nobody and become a somebody?
I wouldn't view that as a handicap. You may start with zero credibility. That doesn't mean that you can't build up credibility.
In a few weeks, like John Hughes will stand before a Bizdom panel, PowerPointing his way through his own business plan. It's taken a long time to get here. He applied for Bizdom a few years ago when it just started. He didn't know much about it then. Nobody did.
So did you feel this was a risk you were taking at all?
Not really, no. One of the biggest motivators for me is thinking that I'm going to regret something when I look back. I knew if I looked back 10 years from now and didn't take the chance, I would regret it.
But this was, at that point, a brand new thing. No, didn't have much of a track record. You said it had one page on the website.
And I think to the average person, it might be like, oh, I don't know if I'm going to do this. But, I mean, if you're an entrepreneur, that's what you look for. You look for those new things where you can make your mark in it.
John knows that most new businesses fail, but he won't dwell on that. He says he's learned to be an optimist from his parents, a trait that came in handy a few years ago as Detroit fell into recession. His father took an early buyout from GM. His mother's real estate business took a dive. At the same time, John had been accepted at the University of Michigan, but there was a problem. Here's John's mother, Patrice Hughes.
The real estate industry in the Metro Detroit area changed drastically, so our finances just weren't there. So 2 weeks before he was to leave, we told him we wouldn't be able to help him.
The cost of room and board at the University of Michigan would have tugged too hard at the family budget.
I mean, I'm telling everybody my son's going to U of M. He's had his going away party from work. And yes, initially it's like, wow, how did that happen? I was momentarily devastated. And I know it was devastating to him. And I asked him how he felt about that. And he looked at me and said, well, you know, you have to do what you have to do. Basically, you have to make the best of the situations that you're dealt with in life.
John ended up at a nearby college so he could save money by living at home. In fact, he still lives at home.
I mean, it's hard to be 25 and live with your parents.
How often can you go out to eat or go out on a date or go out and do anything?
I choose not to date at all right now because it's not a good situation. I mean, because first, I'm strapped for time, so I wouldn't have time to commit to a relationship. Second, I'm strapped for money, so I couldn't take anybody anyplace nice. And then third, I live with my parents, so.
John says he's talked with his parents about what it was like when they were in their 20s.
Like, my parents, you know, you got out of college, you could get a decent job now. You might just make the same that you would have made without going to college at all. So I think it just made us more creative, more hardworking.
Do you think that, I mean, do you see that in your generation among the people you know?
Yeah, because the economic times, there's no choice. If you want to make something of yourself right in this day and age, you have to hustle.
Especially in a place like Detroit. Yes, John wants to base his business here, but he also has to. It's required by his backers at Bizdom University. Their goal is to create jobs and a spirit of enterprise in a city that could use a lot of both.
Do you ever worry about your own sort of reality check here? Because Detroit is going through a really hard time, maybe the toughest in this entire country right now. You ever think?
Probably on a daily basis, yeah. Yeah, I mean, but it's, if by some crazy chance I go down with the ship, I go down with the ship and I start over. I'm still young, you know, and I've read a lot of articles that say people are starting businesses because it's just at a point where it's like, you know, there's no way I can get a job. So I might as well start a business.
John jokes that Detroit needs more people like him, smart and stubborn enough to try to revive a dying city in a sick economy. Think of it this way, he says. If a new business can succeed right here, right now, it's golden. For NPR News, I'm Judy Woodruff.
Recessions can be a good time to start a business. That's what some research says, and you can read about it at npr.org. Tune in this evening to the News Hour with Jim Lehrer to see more in the series Generation Next. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm David Green. Consider this nightmare scenario. You get sick, and your health insurance company cancels your policy. A House of Representatives committee recently called in insurance executives to explain how this could happen. NPR's Joanne Silberner was there.
When an insurer cancels a policy after the policyholder files a claim, it's called rescission. Insurers do it when they find a health detail missing in the original application. People who have insurance on their own rather than through their employers are at risk. Congressional investigators found 20,000 cases of rescission in 5 years of records from three insurers. Sometimes a policy was rescinded because people deliberately left out parts of their health histories. But some omissions were inadvertent or immaterial. And in those cases, insurers should not have done it, says Congressman Barton Stupak, a Michigan Democrat.
Look, they sign you up for health insurance, and as long as you're healthy and you're paying your premiums, everything is wonderful. As soon as you get ill, when you need them to stand behind you, they're finding excuses.
Some insurers gave employees bonuses for cutting people off and instituted automatic lookbacks when people filed for expensive medical care. The anger over these practices is bipartisan. Here's Republican Joe Barton of Texas at the hearing.
There is no reason on God's green earth that somebody ought to have their health insurance revoked because of some inadvertent admission that's not related to the claim that's being submitted to the health insurance company.
But that's what happened to Barton's constituent, Robin Baton. On the Friday before a scheduled Monday mastectomy, she got a cancellation note from her insurer. She hadn't told her insurer about having had acne or a rapid heartbeat years earlier.
I pray no one has to go through the sheer agony that I have had to endure for 1 year. I did not deserve to have my insurance canceled.
It took a phone call from Barton to the head of her insurance company to get her mastectomy covered. Otto Raditz of Illinois was awaiting a stem cell transplant for lymphoma. He got canceled because of an unintentional omission. His sister, Peggy Raditz, testified that his doctor had not told him about a weak blood vessel and gallstones. The insurer reversed its decision only after she got the state attorney general involved.
Had they not been able to find his doctor, who was retired and on a fishing trip in another state, they still might not have believed him.
Three insurance company executives testified that they have to be able to retroactively cancel policies. Otherwise, they might sell policies without knowing the true risk. Richard Collins is CEO of Golden Rule Insurance Company.
Under our current system, failure to act on these cases is fundamentally unfair to those working families that play by the rules, because it would severely limit our ability to provide quality and affordable health insurance.
The three insurance CEOs suggested a solution, a system where everyone has insurance, so the costs of illness are spread over more people. The committee members had their own immediate solutions. Insurers could vet applications as they come in, rather than looking back after someone gets sick. And the companies could only cancel people who had knowingly lied. Representative Barton Stupak tried to get the insurers to promise not to do any more rescissions.
Let me ask each of our CEOs this question, starting with you, Mr. Hamm. Would you commit today that your company will never rescind another policy unless there was intentional fraudulent misrepresentation in the application?
I would not commit to that.
Nor would the other CEOs, which elicited a warning from Representative Joe Barton. If the insurers don't figure out a way to make rescissions more fair, Congress may find a way to do it for them. Joanne Silberner, NPR News, Washington.
I'm Sean Johnson in Madison, where lawmakers are putting the finishing touches on the state budget for the next 2 years. And with the $6.6 billion hole to fill, there are no popular choices. Few residents embrace new taxes, new fees, and cuts across state government. Those include cuts to school districts, like one in Waupun, an hour north of Madison. At summer school in Waupun today, students took turn dancing at a PE class in the school's gym. Watching them, Superintendent Randy Refslin says his district decided to close three schools this year to save money. That was before he found out more cuts were coming.
Honestly, it was like somebody punched us in the gut.
Teachers in Refslin's district avoided layoffs by agreeing to take a 3-day furlough. State employees had no choice. they'll have to take 8 unpaid days off in each of the next 2 years. Even so, as many as 1,400 could lose their jobs. To fend off deeper cuts, the legislature has tentatively agreed to raise taxes on such things as cigarettes. Income and sales taxes won't go up for everyone, but wealthy residents will pay more. The state Senate also proposed getting rid of Wisconsin's tax break on capital gains. That concerns Mark Buer, who connects investors with fledgling biotech companies.
When you raise the capital gains tax, behavior is affected. People don't sell things and they don't buy things.
Governor Jim Doyle wants instead to scale back the tax break for investors and raise a tax on oil companies. Whatever lawmakers decide, the governor wants them to decide it soon.
This is a 2-year budget, and if they delay, it gets a lot harder to make the cuts and to get the savings that you need with every day that passes.
And with every day that passes, there's increasing pressure on legislators to reach some sort of an agreement. Clearly, lawmakers here are eager to fill this enormous budget deficit and move forward. For NPR News, I'm Sean Johnson in Madison.